It might feel like a sleepy news day on this summer-like Friday in the Valley, but oh no, my friend, it is anything but. In Washington, D.C., Congress votes on ending the government shutdown, and it didn't go well. In the Gaza Strip, Hamas says it will accept President Trump's plan to end the war with Israel, including a massive concession that some said would never happen. In Moorhead, the culprit is in custody after that armed robbery on a quiet weeknight, and you won't believe who did it. And in Cass County, North Dakota, authorities say they're seeing an alarming trend in illegal drugs. Other than that, not much going on here today on the Steve Hallstrom Show. We've got a ton to tell you about, my friend. A ton of very interesting news stories. We've got a couple of interesting interviews coming up today as well. If you like stories about crime, we've got those. If you like stories about drugs and law enforcement, we've got those. If you like stories about overseas wars that affect the United States, we've got those. We've got stories about government shutdown. We've got guests coming on to talk about the economic environment, not only in our country, but in the upper Midwest as well. Yes, it's going to be a very busy day here on the Steve Hallstrom Show. You picked a good show to tune into today. If you got a little two-hour drive ahead of you, absolutely perfect, because we're going to cover a lot of bases for you. I think you'll learn a lot. I certainly think I will, too, from what's happening in the news cycle as we talk to guests today and as I learn from you. It's always great to listen to your perspective and your wisdom. This is one of the smartest audiences, really, I would say, all day long here on this station that you're going to find anywhere. And I learn something from all of you pretty much every day. So with that being said, there are a number of ways where you can contribute to the conversation and make us all a little smarter. 701-271-1100 is the phone line. And that's the Valley Christian Counseling and Wellness phone line. They've recently expanded and can get you in fast. They now offer counseling, occupational therapy, physical therapy, and a nurse practitioner. Make an appointment and get in very soon at valleychristian.co. You can email us, studio@flagfamily.com. You can text me at 701-237-1590. No matter how you do it, make sure you're part of the show today. Be very interested to hear from you as we roll along. I'm coming to you live today from the Drive with Vision Studios, Vision Ford Lincoln in Wahpeton. They have me in a brand new vehicle, and I absolutely love it. And they make buying a car, truck, or SUV so dang easy and simple, quick. Whatever word you want to pick that means good, that's how they do it down there at Vision Ford Lincoln in Wahpeton. Starting to see a lot of those Lincolns around town, and they're coming from Wahpeton and Vision Ford Lincoln. Okay, let's get right to it here, because we don't have much time to waste if we're going to get through everything today. Let's get to the 4 o'clock wrap, our semi-automatic storylines that we do every weekday here at 4 o'clock as we begin the show. We start out with the almanac, and it today is October 3rd, 2025, but you wouldn't know it based on our temperatures. 91 is the last temperature that I saw. We were looking for a high right around 90. Record high for today is 93. So not sure if we'll get there, but we're going to be really close. That was back in 1922. Record low, 16 back in 1883. Average high for this day is only 64. So we're a good 25 degrees or so above average. And our low temperature, our average low is 41 degrees. So here we go. Current, let me just kind of refresh this here right now and try to get you an updated temperature. And we are at 92, so we've moved up since I checked last. So 1 degree short of the record high temp. We may get there today. Hot and windy here. The warmest weather of the summer is coming in October. What can we tell you? Sunrise this morning was at 7:29. Sunset will be at 7:02. We will lose 3 minutes and 18 seconds of daylight today. And when we get back together on Monday, the sunset will be at 6:56. Yes, before 7 o'clock. Ugh. Tough when this time of year comes around for those of us that love summer. In the markets today, we saw new record highs on the Dow and the S&P. The NASDAQ gave back a few points today. Not many, but a few. So that one down from a record high. But the Dow finished at 46,758. We're almost at 50,000 on the Dow Jones Industrials, up 238 points. S&P 500 up about just a point and a half, 6,715. NASDAQ down 63 to close at 22,780. WTI crude oil today hanging right about where it was yesterday, $60.72, as we are on the lower end of that trend line that we've been on here for about the last 2-3 months. Gold today of $44 to close at $3,912. We're almost at $4,000 gold. Silver up $1.61, almost 4 percentage points at $47.97. Bitcoin today, that's going up too. People are buying coins and gold and precious metals and things you can't even define, like Bitcoin sometimes. People are buying it. Bitcoin up about $1,600 right now at $122,501. And I'm just going to refresh my chart here because I want to say that we might right now be in record territory on Bitcoin. Let me do this here quick. Yeah, we are there. Today, the trade topped 123. I shouldn't say topped. It just continues to go. For a time, it briefly touched 123,000, and that is an all-time record high. So if you bought Bitcoin back at the middle point of 2023, when it was 22,000, you've done pretty darn well. Yes, you have. AAA says the average price of a gallon of regular unleaded gas is $3.15. That's down a penny from yesterday. North Dakota, $2.88. Minnesota, $2.93. South Dakota, $2.89. Diesel fuel at $3.70, unchanged for a third straight day. In the news cycle today, wow, do we have haymaker news stories on a Friday afternoon. Democrats are refusing to budge in the Senate, and hopes for a quick end to the government shutdown were shot down today as President Trump readied plans to unleash layoffs and cuts across the federal government. On the third day of the shutdown, reports Reuters, try and say that one time slow, I guess, another Senate vote to advance a Republican bill that would reopen the government failed on a 54-44 tally, well short of the 60 needed to end a filibuster and pass the legislation. House Speaker Mike Johnson announced that their chamber will not be open for legislative business next week. And it's being speculated by observers that that is meant to force the Senate to work with the government funding bill that's been passed by the House. So senators headed for the exits, expecting no more votes over the weekend. And it looks like we're in this shutdown for a little while longer. We'll see what President Trump does. He's talking tough about making some big changes to the government, ending some positions, kind of continuing that DOGE theme. See what next week holds. Next week could be very, very interesting. And Democrats, they're just going to pop some popcorn and watch the whole thing happen. Also today in the Gaza Strip, Hamas said today that it has accepted some elements of President Trump's plan to end the war in Gaza, including giving up power and releasing all remaining hostages, but that other elements of the deal require further consultation. So two big concessions right there. We'll see if they stick to it. Wouldn't that be amazing if we got all the hostages out of there, whether they're dead or alive? Wow. Here's a big story from Fargo. Exit interviews obtained by Valley News Live are shining an overwhelmingly positive light on leadership in the Fargo Police Department. A lot of us have been wondering about this. Of the 38 interviews that were provided to Valley News Live, 24 of them checked off 10s across the board, or mostly 10s, on their exit survey, the highest score possible. Categories were things like professional environment, company benefits, career opportunities, supervision received, working conditions, pay, type of work performed, and job met expectations. So 24 out of 38, not too bad. 10 more employees gave mostly favorable scores but did not provide any additional feedback. Of the negative feedback listed, the majority focused on the workload for officers and detectives, saying it was too high for their staffing levels. Some said lack of growth opportunities, and others cited low pay for the work performed. Interesting. Good work there by Valley News Live. Here's another biggie. Kirsten Baszler, North Dakota's superintendent of public instruction, has been officially confirmed to be the Assistant Secretary of Elementary and Secondary Education at the U.S. Department of Education. The nomination was confirmed today. Baszler said in a statement, "I'm honored, humbled, and incredibly excited to have received this final vote of confidence from the U.S. Senate." She gives credit to North Dakota Senators Hoban and Kramer for their support and pushing this through. She will serve now under U.S. Secretary of Education Linda McMahon. The current federal government shutdown will delay her swearing in. She will oversee the office that shapes and supports K-12 education policy. Congratulations to her. A story coming from the Star Tribune today gives additional perspective on Rob Kupick's potential vote on a ban of what's been called assault weapons, assault-style weapons, and high-capacity magazines. Kupick told the Star Tribune when asked about the particular issue of the assault, quote-unquote, assault rifle, assault weapons ban, Kupick said, and I'm quoting, that he would support some new efforts like expanding the red flag law and thought there may be some room to do something on high-capacity magazines. But he's skeptical of a state-level assault weapons ban, which he said would be better done at the federal level. Even if a ban on the sale of assault weapons were to pass, Kupick says the sheer number of existing guns in this country suggests to him the issue of gun violence cannot be fully addressed through legislation alone. He said, quote, I don't even know how you get at that, but I think as a society we need to be a little kinder and gentler. Very interesting. So he says he is skeptical of a ban and said it's better handled at the federal level, but he didn't say no. He didn't say no. My suspicion is he will be a yes vote, but I could be wrong. We'll see. WDAY Radio reports that over the last 9 months in Cass County, authorities have seen an alarming trend involving the use of illegal drugs. There has been an increase in the amount of fentanyl powder, methamphetamine, and the number of firearms seized connected to drug use. Jesse Johnner, the sheriff, says we're seeing a little bit of decline in the M30 pills, but we're seeing an increase in fentanyl powder coming into our communities. North Dakota BCI data shows that from January 1 to September 30th, there have been 917 grams of fentanyl seized compared to just 143 grams last year. Ugh, no bueno. Other news, we know more about who held up the Moorhead convenience store, Casey's, on 30th Avenue South on Tuesday night. A 16-year-old boy has been arrested in connection with the armed robbery. West Fargo officers stopped a vehicle on Thursday, found a stolen gun believed to be used in the robbery, leading them to a Fergus Falls teen. He was arrested without incident in Fergus Falls and was taken to the jail in Moorhead. The investigation continues to see if more people were involved. 16-year-old kid on a Tuesday night with a gun, doing a stick up at the Casey's. Crazy. Bismarck Tribune reports the North Dakota Department of Environmental Quality will stop studying avenues the state could take to reduce its climate warming emissions, the agency's director announced. I'm reading this story verbatim because you know I love these terms like climate warming emissions, which there is not proof of. DEQ Director Dave Glatt said on Monday that the agency has discontinued its efforts under the Climate Pollution Reduction Grant from the EPA in September and is going to wrap up any remaining work in the coming weeks. The state got a $3 million federal grant as part of an effort to examine ways it could reduce its emissions without significantly changing its economy, but they've only spent about $1.3 million, and so the remainder of the money will stay with the EPA. Isn't that nice? $1.7 million never had to be spent after all. I would argue the first $1.3 million didn't either, but alas, That train has left the station. Hay is in the barn, whatever you want to say. WCCO-TV in Minneapolis reports that Minnesotans are getting older and people in the state are earning less money. Between 2011 and 2020, Minnesota lost 0.6% of its population to other states, while at the same time, Florida gained 7%. Minnesota has experienced a significant increase in minority populations as well. In 1960, Minnesota was 97% white. In 2023, that number dropped to 76. By comparison, in the 2020 census, the U.S. as a whole was about 58% white. So I'm not making any editorial comments about any of that. I'm just telling you those are the numbers. And it reminds me of that I can tease for you a little bit. I'm going to play you part of A Precarious State, the Rick Capcella documentary. We got permission today from the producer of the program to play a little segment of it for you. And it's on YouTube, and it's about an hour long. I've made it through the first 20 minutes, and already I'm thinking this is one of the most influential pieces that's been done in Minnesota in a long time. It reminds me of Liz Collins' documentary, Fall of Minneapolis. But yeah, people are leaving Minnesota. Lost 0.6% of its population to other states between 2011 and 2020, while at the same time Florida gained 7%. This note from Gray Media, I didn't see it on the Valley News Live website, but it's probably there. Quick Trip has announced it's getting rid of pennies at its 900 convenience stores. Cash transactions will be rounded down to the nearest 5 cents to the advantage of customers paying in cash. Credit card and digital transactions will remain the same. So the penny is going by the wayside. In national news today, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth said today he ordered another strike on a small boat he said was carrying drugs in the waters off Venezuela, expanding what the Trump administration has declared an armed conflict with the cartels. President Trump said in his own social media post that the boat was loaded with enough drugs to kill 25 to 50,000 people and implied it was entering American territory while off the coast of Venezuela. Hegseth says the strike killed 4 men but did not give any details on who they were or what group they might have belonged to. And I was talking to my buddy Jay Thomas in the hallway today, and he said, did you see what the federal government's doing in Venezuela? I said, no. He said they have a whole bunch of troops and boats that are over there, and people are wondering if they're going to actually invade Venezuela. I said, wow, wouldn't that be a story on a Friday night? So we'll be watching that one for you over the weekend. Sean Diddy Combs gets 4 years in the pokey for that case involving sex workers and violent sexual escapades called freak-offs, which I don't think I've ever used that term on the 4 o'clock wrap before, but I guess there's a first time for everything. Combs, 55 years of age, was convicted in July of flying people around the country, including his girlfriends and male sex workers, to engage in sexual encounters, and he was sentenced today to 4 years and 2 months. Prosecutors wanted 11 years. And because we need something else after that story to finish off our 4 o'clock wrap, I will tell you something very interesting from the local high school football scene. Brooks Bacco, the fine two-way star for the Kindred Vikings, has earned himself the distinction of being a 4-star recruit by all the major college football recruiting services. Now, this is crazy for us to have a 4-star recruit in our part of the world. I have to be honest with you. I don't know if we've had another one. I don't recall it. But when you're a 4-star recruit, generally those are the players that the big boys, the Ohio States, the Michigans, the Floridas, the Texases, the Alabamas are going to be looking at. He's been already offered a full ride to go to Michigan, Duke, and Vanderbilt, so obviously a smart kid as well. He has 15 college offers, tells Valley News Live, who wrote up the story, that he has no timeline on when he plans to make a commitment. Yeah, wow, I would play that out too and see what happens there. I think that he is a junior this year, but I guess I can't be sure. If he was a senior, you probably would have made his decision by now. But isn't that great? We got a 4-star recruit in Kindred, North Dakota. Amazing. So many local kids now getting looks from the big time, the big, big time, and it's pretty darn fun. All right, that's a look at the 4 o'clock wrap. Semi-automatic storylines going rapid fire, catching you up on a busy and eventful Friday here on the Steve Hallstrom Show. When we return, I learned something today about the outlook for soybean growers this fall, and it didn't make me feel a whole lot better about their plight. That's next. Well, we know that soybean farmers in our part of the world are having a tough go of it. Some of the Central America countries are producing a ton of soybeans, Brazil, Argentina, and China's buying from them. Don't know if this is trade war politics or they're just getting better pricing, but they're not buying from us. And because of that, the price you can get isn't a whole lot for soybeans. And in our part of the world, there are a lot of guys that are bringing soybeans out of the field, and they're losing money every bushel that comes in. I saw a story on Brownfield Ag News earlier today that I thought was interesting. It was a quote from a farmer in West Central Minnesota, Swift County, which Swift County, I want to say it's maybe down by Marshall, kind of that direction. I could be wrong on that. Someone will correct me if they know differently. But the quote they had from a farmer named Harmon Wiltz, He says, it's as tough as I've ever seen from the standpoint that the basis is so wide right now at about $1.50. And that means the local price is that much less of what you can get on other markets nationally. He says, futures markets aren't good. The basis is wide. And a number of elevators are saying, hey, we'll take your beans, but you have to sell them the day you bring them in. So that leaves no upside potential. He said, it's putting a lot of people in a bad situation. And last year wasn't good either. This year is worse. I've got a lot of neighbors that are pretty worried, and so am I, about what cash flow is going to look like for 2025 and 2026. He says he's been farming for 30 years, and he said this is the most challenging time they've ever had. What jumped out to me there was a number of elevators are saying, hey, we'll take your beans, but you have to sell them the day you bring them in. I had heard that some elevators aren't even taking them, but now I'm hearing this, that you got to sell them right away. And I'm sure that's something that all of you who are out in the ag community knew already. I just hadn't heard that. But yeah, I mean, normally you bring it to the elevator and you say, can you store it for a while? And hopefully prices get better. But they're saying they won't store them, or maybe they've got so much already that they can't take them. I'm not sure what the justification is on that. But one way or another, the farmer has fewer options. With bad prices, that's not a great combination. It's 4:31 on the Steve Hallstrom Show. We are just getting started here on the program today. When we return, we're going to visit with Dr. Michael Klein from Tufts University about how the international trade is affecting the economy. We'll talk a little bit about soybeans and other things as well. First, though, let's head on down to the newsroom. Well, most people are thinking about football and maybe a campfire or grilling out on a Friday night. Not here on the Steve Hallstrom Show. We're talking about international trade today. Our show may not be for everybody. It's just for the people that want to learn a little bit more about this great world around us and how these things affect us at home. Dr. Michael Klein from Tufts University joins us on the Valley Christian Counseling and Wellness phone line. Dr. Klein is an economics professor at Tufts University in Boston. He served as the chief economist in the Office of International Affairs of the U.S. Treasury Department in 2010 and 2011. He's a research associate of the National Bureau of Economic Research and the founder and executive editor of EconoFact, a nonpartisan website that provides economic analysis on timely policy issues. And he's going to be part of Chelly Institute at NDSU, their Human Progress and Flourishing Workshop, 1 week from today. Dr. Klein, thank you for your time. Nice to meet you.
Oh, nice to meet you as well, Steve. And I would just say that this should be of interest to everybody, not just, you know, people who might otherwise be looking at football or campfires. They should be focused on this as well because it's going to affect their livelihood.
I completely agree. Yes, I try to find interesting things that really matter. There is a lot of talk about, you know, different things, and P. Diddy got sentenced today and all that. I like to talk about the things that really matter, and I think this is one of them. So thank you for taking the time, and I very much agree with you. I want to first of all ask you how you got connected with the Chelly Institute and why you decided to participate in their series.
Oh, well, they reached out to me because of something I had written for EconoFact. EconoFact is an initiative of the Fletcher School at Tufts University. And as you mentioned, we're nonpartisan. We try to make economic issues accessible to the general public. So I'd written something about international trade, and they reached out to me and was very happy to come to North Dakota and speak to people in Fargo about this next week.
Now, you obviously have your political beliefs like we all do. How hard is it to keep that out of your analysis when you're doing a summary of these complex issues? Because our political beliefs often shape the things we talk about and how we look at situations that come in front of us. How hard is it to keep that out of your analysis and your work?
Well, Steve, it's actually the case that economists across the political spectrum tend to agree a lot more than what people might expect if they're just watching the news. I had this experience in the 1990s. Somebody called me up and asked if I'd do a radio interview about NAFTA, and they asked whether or not I was in favor of it, and I said, you know, basically yes. And they said, oh, we have lots of people who say that. We're looking for somebody else. So, you know, they'll call 100 people. 5 will say they're against something. 95 will say they're for it, and they'll get one of the 5 and one of the 95. But I think that gives a warped view to the public of how much consensus there actually is about a lot of issues in economics.
How important are conversations like what the Chaley Institute is doing?
I think it's really important. You know, in a democracy, people need to make well-informed choices. And that was the goal behind starting EconoFact more than 8 years ago, that there's this chasm between what economists do and what people understand. And part of it, you know, is the fault of economists, because we have our own jargon. We have our, you know, the way that we explain things, which is a good shorthand for us, but it makes it a little bit impenetrable to other people. And also, you know, the statistical analyses and empirical work that we do, mostly people don't really bother to try to reach out. So the whole idea of EconoFact was to bridge that chasm. And I think that's really important in a democracy, that people understand what they're voting for.
Well, I'll let you kind of go for a little bit on the gist of what you're going to be talking about next week. I'll just kind of take the kind of a theme of your presentation and turn it into a question. How is international trade and international trade policy affecting our economy currently?
Well, trade is an important part of the economy in both production and consumption. So people, when they think about trade, sometimes they might think about, you know, some manufacturers in certain areas that are being put out of business by foreign competitors. So that's one part of trade. But what they don't think about is the fact that other manufacturers actually rely on imported input goods to be able to sell at a competitive price. And they also don't think about perhaps how much of the goods they consume come from abroad. I mean, if you were just to think about sort of what you did today, you know, you had maybe orange juice from Brazil and coffee from Costa Rica. You might have driven a car whose parts came from both Canada and Mexico, even if it was assembled in the United States. Your clothes could be coming from Thailand or Bangladesh. So, you know, it's a very pervasive part of our economic existence. And I think it's important for people to understand that we're living in an interconnected world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very much so. Speaking of connections here in our part of the world, we have a big ag community, and corn and soybeans are two of our biggest crops here. And of course, neither of them is doing fairly well at the moment. And the soybean trade especially has been difficult because we've got foreign countries now providing a lot of the soybeans that North Dakota and other farmers in our country were providing before. What perspective might you have on ag commodities and what's happening internationally and how that's affecting our farmers?
Well, a similar thing happened in the first Trump administration, where there were retaliatory moves by China. And China, of course, is a big market for things like soybeans and other agricultural products. And so what the administration ended up doing was, you know, bailing out farmers to a certain extent. So to the extent that people are talking about tariffs raising revenue, this was offsetting that. And also it's distorting markets. You know, in North Dakota and other places in the Midwest of America, the farmers are incredibly productive and can do really well if they can compete in the world market. But the kinds of tariffs that we've been seeing against Canada and Mexico and China, which are the three biggest markets for North Dakota agricultural goods, you know, those are inviting retaliation, and those are going to hurt people who want to export and sell abroad.
I've talked to a number of farmers who went through what you're talking about in 2019 during the first Trump administration, and I think you can find farmers that say those were punitive tariffs, and then there's others, which I tend to hear more of, saying at the time it was sort of a tenuous situation, but it turned out to be a good thing in the long run. As we look back on that situation, do you think there's more evidence to indicate that that was a good thing in the long run, or that farmers were unfairly hurt?
By good thing, you mean that farmers were better off because of both the tariffs
in the long run?
Payments to
yes,
them?
Sir. Yep.
I know, but that's kind of a distorted thing, right? That, you know, in one hand you're taking away, with another hand you're giving. And farmers are productive. They could stand on their own. And if they, you know, if an administration starts a trade war, and then they bail out people, that's a very inefficient way to run an economy. And, you know, if people are interested in free markets, they should be interested in free markets, not just within the United States, but between the United States and other countries as well.
So as you look at that from sort of an agnostic perspective politically, you would say probably not the best move in the first Trump administration and maybe not in the second Trump administration either. Am I summarizing correctly?
Yeah, you know, again, going back to the point I made earlier, they're out of the University of Chicago Booth School of Business. They do these surveys of, really leading economists from across the spectrum, and they ask them, you know, what do you think about this policy? And they'll get people who strongly agree or disagree. The striking thing is when you ask about broad across-the-board tariffs, there is greater unanimity among economists across the political spectrum than on any other single issue. And tariffs are, you know, in some ways, tax. And the question is, who pays the tax? And evidence seems to suggest that it's Americans who are paying the tax right now through higher prices, and also that firms are cutting their prices to offset some of the effects on tariffs. So it's hurting both businesses and consumers. And if you think about who's paying the tax, in a way, it's like a national sales tax. And we know that sales taxes are regressive. That is, people at the lower income levels are paying a bigger proportion of their income for it. But it's worse than that. You know, if there was a national sales tax, all goods of a certain type would be paying the tax. But here what happens, and there's a lot of evidence of this, is that when the price of imports goes up, the price of domestic goods that compete with them go up as well. You know, why wouldn't they? But there's no revenue collected on the domestic goods. So it's a very inefficient way to raise money. It distorts the economy. And it's just, you know, something that can lead to trade wars that are going to be damaging for everybody.
I've listened to a number of economists that I see on some networks that I watch, and I be honest to tell you that I am a regular viewer of the Larry Kudlow show on Fox Business, and he has Art Laffer on, and those two talk about this quite a bit. And their perspective on this, just to kind of give a counterpoint to what you said, and I'd like you to respond, is that there's only so much money to go around. So if a price of something goes up, A, someone doesn't have to pay it, so it can be more expensive on the store shelf, but it doesn't necessarily mean that someone has to pay it. And then if they do, they only have a certain amount of money, and so they're going to be shorting their spending somewhere else. So in the end, that consumer isn't spending more money in the long run. They're just spending different proportions of money at different places. How would you assess that summary?
Well, you know, suppose they put a tax on, I don't know, what's your favorite drink?
I'll go Diet Coke.
Okay, that's safe. Suppose they put it like 100% tax on Diet Coke. So you're going to spend less on Diet Coke, might buy, you know, some other thing instead. But the fact that you were buying Diet Coke means that that's what you preferred, and you're forced away from that because of this arbitrary tax. So, you know, that's kind of a funny argument because it means that people aren't really making choices based on what they want. Because, hey, you'll just spend money on something else instead. But, you know, we vote with our dollars. And if there's a tax on something, which is what a tariff is, then we're forced to buy things that we wouldn't necessarily want as much. But because the price has been raised on things we do want, you know, we're not as well off.
Mm. I should probably drink less Diet Coke, so it probably wouldn't be all bad if tariffs were put in at 100% on Diet Coke. I might have to drink more water or something like that. Good stuff.
Well,
there.
There's actually an economic argument for like taxing, not Diet Coke necessarily, but sugary drinks.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure.
So, you know, there are these ideas of things called externalities where people get, you know, sick because of, there are all sorts of diseases associated with drinking too much sugary drinks.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure, yeah. A Diet Coke doesn't have the sugar, but it's got all kinds of other junk in there that I'm sure that I don't need. Before I let you go, you've given us, I think, a pretty honest assessment of your opinions on the Trump policy, trade policy there. I'd like to see if you have an example of something you think that's been done positively by the current administration as a kind of a counterbalance to the tariff position that you have. Is there anything that you see from Trump's administration and his cabinet, his people, that you think has been healthy and has been good for the American economy?
I'd have to think about that, because so much of the stuff that has been going on has not been good for the economy and not been good for working people. And, you know, and there's also, strikes me as, a lot of corruption. So, you know, in a way, your question is, it's a little bit like going back, you know, there are 95 things that are really bad and 5 things that are good. Can you pick one of the 5 that's good? So I don't know if you want me to answer that as a way to show that I'm not partisan.
Not at all. I'm not accusing you of being partisan at all. I just, you'd given a pretty honest assessment of your opinion on the tariff policy, both in the first and the second administration. And I just like to try to find balance. So I was wondering if there's something positive that you find in what they've done. I'll throw this out just for your honest comments on it. The Tax Cuts and Jobs Act has been basically extended now with the recent legislation that got passed in July. Do you think overall that is a positive, and like you had talked about, pro-working families? Because that's how it's being touted by the White House, that it's very good for working families, with the limiting taxes on overtime and tips and then the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act being extended. Do you find anything valuable there?
So, you know, that's more than a very brief conversation. Let me just say, on Econofact, Econofact.org, we have a number of things about that. My impression of the Tax Cut and Jobs Act is that it was very regressive. That is, it benefited people at the upper levels of income much more than people at the lower levels of income. And the issue of not taxing overtime or tips, I think, is very fraught. For example, if you look at who really benefits from not taxing tips, it's not clear that it's, you know, lower income people who are purported to be helped by that. And furthermore, you know, it creates all sorts of problems. Like, people might start to say, well, you know, I'm earning tip income, not regular income. So it opens the door for all sorts of things. And finally, you know, if you think about that, suppose somebody's working 2 jobs and somebody else is working overtime. The person working overtime gets the tax break. The person working 2 jobs does not. And that doesn't strike me as fair. I don't know, you know, what you would think about that. But, you know, why? It's, you know, it's sort of like a, it sounds good politically. It doesn't really pass the smell test.
Okay. Yeah, your phone is starting to cut out a little bit there, but I think we caught most. That's okay. That sounds good. I could continue that conversation too. Unfortunately, we are out of time on the hour here, but you've made points that I think we're all considering, and we appreciate you taking some time to do this. We appreciate you also being part of what they're doing at Shelley Institute here coming up next weekend. And whenever folks give time to add to the conversation here locally, we consider that a good thing. So thank you, Dr. Klein, for doing this today, and thanks for being involved in what we're doing up here in this part of the world at Shelley Institute as well. And have a great rest of the day, and thank you for taking the time.
Thanks for having me on the show. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Dr. Klein. We appreciate it very much. Dr. Michael Klein from Tufts University. And if you want to find out more about the Shelley Institute, simple website to go to, just Google search Shelley Institute at North Dakota State University. You'll be able to find out more about not only Dr. Klein, but the other experts that will be part of that series coming up over the next few weeks. It's 4:56. Steve Hallstrom show back right after this. Well, that was interesting. I got a couple of comments on that. I thought his answer on the infinite supply of money was a little thin, and we can talk about the rest of it too here after top of the hour. But I love those conversations. It's good to hear people. It's good to have your mind challenged by things, but I don't know that I buy all of what I heard there. Steve Hallstrom show continues after this. Okay, we got a lot of stuff to do here in the second hour of the show, and the pile just got even higher of things to do, because I was just able to confirm an interview with Rick Cupcella. And he's the producer and anchor of that documentary, A Precarious State, that we've been talking about. I'd planned on playing you a little segment of that, but we're going to visit with Rick about it and kind of how he put that whole thing together at 5:35 today. So we got a lot to do, so let's get right to it here. I do have to give you just a couple thoughts on the guest that we had. I do sincerely appreciate people taking time to join us on the program, and I actually like talking to people that don't agree with things that I agree with or see things differently. The professor we had on, Dr. Klein, I should have known a Boston professor, right? I have issues with the fundamental state of his points. When we're talking about, I asked him about, you know, he said, well, the tariffs are a tax. I said, okay. But there are also people that say people only have a certain amount of money to spend. And when that money is gone, they don't have any more to spend. So if I spend more money on something else, I have to spend less money on something else. So that consumer isn't really affected unless they decide to spend more and put it on credit, basically. So he said, well, yeah, that might be if your Diet Coke gets more expensive but and you want to buy something else, but then you lose choice. Well, that's not the question. And from what I understand of economists, they are supposed to be sticking to the question at hand, and that is, how do all of these maneuvers impact me and the money that I have and what I spend? So when you start bringing in, well, yeah, then you lose choice, that's not something an economist would typically comment on because it's not what they think about. So I thought that was an interesting choice. And then the comment he made about, I said, well, let's talk about the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. I mean, that's got to be good for workers, right? And he said, well, it helps some people, but not others. And maybe it doesn't help the working class. I didn't think that anybody was arguing about that anymore. So I guess I've got to go back and take a look at the data here. But his example of it might help overtime people, but doesn't help other regular workers. Well, if 9 people out of 10 get a benefit, that's still a good thing for most of the country. So, look, the guy's way smarter than I am. I just, there are certain parts of how he broke down his arguments, and maybe I didn't give him enough time to work them through, but I left myself wanting more there. I wish I'd had more time because that could have been kind of fun, actually. But we appreciate his time, and I tried to be polite but pushed back at times when I thought it was warranted. So that's what we do here on the show. Okay, we got to get to the top 5 at 5 here because we have 2 guests coming up, and I'm excited to visit with both of them. So let's do this. Top 5 at 5 brought to you by Dakota Implant and Sedation Center in Fargo. And Dr. Matt Eaton at Dakota Implant and Sedation Center has dedicated his professional life to transforming smiles and restoring confidence one patient at a time. When you meet him, you'll feel it. It's not just a job. It's his calling. At Dakota Implant and Sedation Center in Fargo, Dr. Eaton helps everybody, young, seasoned, and everyone in between. Whether you need a single tooth or a full mouth restoration, he's here to help with skill, compassion, and experience. Whether you've been hiding your smile for years or you're ready for a fresh start, trust his skill, compassion, and experience. Visit DakotaDentalImplant.com today. Story number 1. There was another vote in the Senate, and Democrats did not budge. Therefore, the federal government shutdown will continue at least through the weekend. 54-44 was a tally, short of the 60 needed to end a filibuster. So they've gotten a couple of Democrats to come over to the Republican side, but not nearly enough. So watch for the president to continue to flex the muscle that he can do during a shutdown with some of these layoffs and firings and things like that. And the Democrats are enabling this to happen. Story number 2, Hamas said today that it's accepted some elements of President Trump's plan to end the war in the Gaza Strip, including releasing all remaining hostages and giving up power. The statement came hours after Trump said Hamas must agree to the deal by Sunday night, threatening an even greater military onslaught nearly 2 years into the war, sparked by the October 7th attack into Israel. Wow, those are 2 big concessions. Now, will they follow through with them? Not really sure. But if you give up the hostages and give up your power, you're kind of ending the war there. I don't know what other elements need to require further consultation. If you do that, basically the war is done, as it should be. Let's hope we can get this done quickly. Valley News Live has story number three. They reviewed 38 exit interviews from the Fargo Police Department. There's been a lot of talk about this. People leaving the department, going other places. There's been some rumblings that morale might not be good, but of the 38 exit interviews, 24 checked off 10s, a score of 10 across the board on a scale of 1 to 10, the highest possible rating. The employees that did not give a perfect 10 gave fairly high marks, generally speaking, across the board, generally favorable scores, but did not provide any additional feedback. And of the negative ones, the reason people said they were leaving was the pay wasn't good enough and a lack of growth opportunities, which is not really anything that, I mean, I guess you can do something about it if you're the chief, but it's not everybody hates the chief and the chief is toxic and all that, which is what we've heard a little bit of. So very interesting there. That's story number three. Story number four, Cass County Sheriff Jesse Johnner tells Valley News Live that we're seeing an increase in fentanyl powder coming into our communities. From January 1 to September 30th, so the first 9 months of the year, there have been 917 grams of fentanyl seized compared to 143 grams in the same time last year. So 143 to 917, an alarming trend, Sheriff Johnner says, with the use of illegal drugs. So that's story number four. And story number five, I've got to put this in because Rob Kupek, the state senator out of Moorhead, is giving more perspective, but not really saying a lot more, to the Star Tribune about the special session that's going to take place next week where Governor Walz is going to float a potential AR ban. So semi-automatic rifle ban that along with high-capacity magazines and some other things as well. This is a big, big deal. And Kupek tells the Star Tribune that he would support some new efforts like expanding the red flag law, but he's skeptical of a state-level assault weapons ban, which he said would be better done at the federal level. He said even if a ban were to pass, he said the sheer number of existing guns in the country suggests that the issue of gun violence cannot be fully addressed through legislation alone. But he didn't say that he wouldn't vote for it. So we'll see what happens next week. And those are what I believe to be the five most consequential stories in the news cycle today. We call it the top five at five. When we return, Upper Midwest business landscape, not easy, but getting better. I heard a story about that just this morning from a local business owner. Will the federal government shutdown be good or bad for those business owners in the long run? We'll talk about that with Josh Astrup from Bell Bank, coming back next on the Steve Holsham Show. Coming to you live from the Drive with Vision Studio. Vision, Ford, Lincoln, and Wappanen, best place to buy a car. If you're looking for a Lincoln SUV, Lincoln sedan, got those great Ford trucks too, Vision, Ford, Lincoln, down Wappanen, go to drivewithvision.com. We are joined on the Valley Christian Counseling and Wellness phone line now by Josh Astrup, VP and Senior Portfolio Manager at Bell Bank. Josh, great to visit with you again. Thanks for taking a few minutes today.
Yes, thank you for having me, Steve.
Good to have you here, sir. We've done this a few times, and I always learn a little bit when we have you on, so we appreciate you getting fitness in your schedule here on this Friday evening. Well, the stock market doesn't seem too worried about this government shutdown. What do we make of this?
No, it certainly does not. And that's one of the things I think when you take a look at the government shutdowns, there's always a lot of hyperbole and a lot of fear mongering. But ultimately, the stock market knows it'll get resolved. It always has in the past, and things will continue. And so, at least in this particular case, the markets seem to certainly be shrugging it off.
Yeah, I take a look at some of these, you know, index levels here, and I think, my gosh, you know, we're sitting with the Dow, you know, knocking on 50,000, S&P 500's near 7,000, the NASDAQ's almost to 25,000. And I think, oh my gosh, if our dads and granddads could see us now with what we have here, it just speaks to no matter what kind of headwinds that the U.S. economy and the businesses that make it up, whatever curveballs you throw at them, there's nothing quite like the American entrepreneurial spirit, is there?
Oh, certainly not. I know it's when you look at the economy here, our businesses tend to always find a way to make things work. And if you look at the largest companies in the world are U.S.-based companies. I believe over in Europe, they don't even have a single trillion-dollar company, whereas we have closing on 10 trillion-dollar companies in the United States. So that entrepreneurial spirit certainly comes through.
Yeah, sure does. So interest rates have been in the news lately. The Federal Reserve did a quarter-point cut, and it looks like there might be a couple more on the way. How fast will those interest rate cuts, how fast will that land with business owners and entrepreneurs where they'll feel more confident in expanding, buying, spending, and all those things that make the economy go around? How much interest rate cut do we need to have, and how fast do you think that's going to get people more confident in behaving differently in their spending?
Well, I think the confidence is there. There's quite a bit of optimism. But as far as seeing the impact of it, what we see traditionally is when the Fed does an interest rate cut, on average, it takes about 10 or 11 months for that to start to flow into the economy and see the results. And so, you know, a 0.25% drop will instantly drop deposit rates that they receive on funds, but loan rates tend to be a little slower to adjust. But if we continue to see a couple more cuts this year and maybe a couple early next year, that's when we'll start to see a noticeable impact on lending rates, and that will likely add to that optimism and start to see some businesses looking at financing a few more things and maybe looking at hiring a few more employees and just overall helping things continue to grow.
That's interesting. So 10 or 11 months. So no matter how big the rate cut is, does that change if it's, a, say, a half point instead of a quarter, or is it about the same?
It's usually about the same, but what you'll see is in the past when the Fed has done cuts like they did last September when they did 50 basis points instead of the traditional 25, that's usually a bit more jarring. Mm-hmm. And if you think back to the financial crisis in 2008, they were doing 1% cuts at a time. And so that's something that when that happens, it's usually a sign there's lots of stress in the economy. And so people tend to be more reserved and not take advantage of those lower rates. And that's why it tends to take a while for those rates to have an impact and start to see some behaviors adjust to it.
Interesting. I think traditional wisdom, at least to the uneducated person like myself, you'd think, oh, 1% would get everybody really excited. But if you're cutting by 1%, there's reasons to believe that there's some cracks in the foundation. And I can see maybe why that might make people a little skittish. That's a great observation. I had not heard that before. So thanks for that. So all these business owners that are trying to make a go of it around here, I actually talked to a business owner today and I said, how's it going? And this is a person in the retail business. And this person said, you know, business is picking up a little bit. It seems like people are just maybe a little less nervous than they used to be. I imagine every business is a little bit different and you can't extrapolate everything across the board the same way. But do you feel that business people in the upper Midwest here, Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, are starting to feel a little bit more at ease with things than maybe they're where they were, say, 3-4 months ago?
I would certainly think so. I know we've had a couple of things, as you mentioned earlier, with the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. Got extended back in July. That provided a lot more certainty, you know, from a tax standpoint, both for consumers and for businesses. And I think a lot of that certainty helps them be more comfortable, and then it helps the customers be more comfortable. And so as they're seeing business be rather steady and we're starting to see a bit more certainty going forward, I think that's certainly a positive for the businesses and for the consumers.
Mm. Will the federal government shutdown be good, bad, neutral? Where do you see that for the U.S. economy? What will the impact be?
I think long term it will probably be a good thing, especially if you look at the potential for some of what are considered those non-essential workers. If there is a potential review and reduction of some of those positions that really aren't contributing a lot economically, long term, that's going to be a good thing because it will certainly reduce government spending and hopefully make us more efficient. What the impacts you'll see, though, you know, in the East Coast where you see a lot more of those federal jobs, those local economies will probably be impacted. Here in the upper Midwest, we don't have nearly as many federal employees, so we won't see an impact even on the short term for it. But long term, I think it's overall healthy if we can reduce some of our government spending and be a bit more efficient.
Yeah. Is inflation a problem right now? Depending on what metric you go by, we're sitting somewhere between 2.5 and 3, something like that, on our inflation. And this, of course, is on top of, you know, 20 to 22% we've seen over the last 4 years already. So certainly nothing is good when prices continue to go up, but the pace is definitely slowed. Is inflation, do you think, a problem, Josh, in our economy right now?
I wouldn't say it's a problem. As you noted, it's down quite a bit from where it had been, you know, just a couple of years ago, but the prices are still getting higher. And as long as wages can keep up with that, it's not as big of an impact. But it, you know, general, it is good to see prices go up because over time prices will go up. You know, the Federal Reserve targets a 2% inflation rate, and we are running slightly above that right now. But I think the consistency of it probably won't pose as much of a problem going forward, as long as we don't see some extreme increases. And what we're still seeing are, you know, beef prices are high, insurance prices are going up dramatically, but we're seeing other prices come down a little bit. So it kind of moderates to where the level we're at now is certainly a comfortable level and certainly not a problem.
Yeah, what's going down? I guess I'm not seeing any of those in my checkbook. What's going down?
Well, I know gas prices have come down slightly.
Oh, true.
You know, oil is down at that $60 a barrel level, but yet we haven't seen gas prices come down in concert with that. Mm-hmm. But we have seen a bit of a moderation there. And with some of the technology that we're continuing to see with AI, the efficiency some companies have, certain software programs are getting a little cheaper. Some certain grocery prices, you know, egg prices were a particular one that were extraordinarily high.
Right.
But when you look at the fact that it only takes about 16 to 24 weeks for a chick to become a laying hen, it's pretty easy to replicate and increase the egg producers. Whereas beef prices being high, you know, it takes a couple of years for a calf to become productive beef, essentially.
Yes. Yeah.
So that'll stay high, but, you know, egg prices down. We've seen a few other grocery items, just kind of selective ones, but we haven't seen as much of a rapid increase as we were experiencing.
All right. Good stuff. Josh, I appreciate you taking the time. We always learn something when we have you on, and we've got to do it again soon because a lot of good stuff there today, and I appreciate you doing it, taking a few minutes. Have a great rest of the day and a great weekend.
Thank you. You as well, Steve.
Thanks, Josh. That's Josh Astrup, VP and Senior Portfolio Manager at Bell Bank. The guy knows his stuff, no doubt about that. All right, 5:30 here on the Steve Alsham Show. When we come back, Rick Cupcella joins us. Rick is the producer and anchor of that documentary, A Precarious State. It aired last night on ABC TV stations around Minnesota. It's on YouTube right now. I'm about 20 minutes through, and I can't wait to watch the other 40. We'll talk to Rick about how the idea came up and why he wanted to do this project when we come back on the Steve Alsham Show. Have you noticed how many Vision Fords and Vision Lincolns you're seeing here in the metro? One of them's mine. You'll get that first car feel all over again because they make buying a car easy. 15 minutes to do the paperwork and then you're done. And they'll come to you after you buy that vehicle for the service as well. They've got 18 service drivers to help get you to your car or get your car to you for those oil changes and service visits when they come up. Buy your Ford from Ward. Drive with Vision. Vision Ford Lincoln in Wappen and online at drivewithvision.com. 5:35, Steve Hallstrom Show, still 92 degrees, record high is 93. I don't know if we're going to get there at this point, but certainly a warm day. We are pleased to be joined on the Valley Christian Counseling and Wellness phone line by Rick Cupcella. Rick is the producer and anchor of the documentary, A Precarious State. It aired last night on TV stations across Minnesota on ABC stations, and it's now on YouTube, and you can watch it as well. And when I looked at it this morning, there's about 35,000 views already. I'm sure it's much higher than that. And we thank Rick for his time. Mr. Cupcella, we appreciate you doing this. I'm sure it's been a whirlwind couple of days, so thank you for carving out a few minutes.
Oh, hey, I'm happy to do it. I appreciate your interest. Thank you.
So I was a young aspiring TV guy back when you were on Care 11, and I was a big fan of yours, and I was sad when you got out of the business because I thought you just did a really good professional job in what you did. So how long have you been out of news now altogether, and why did you leave that business?
You know, it's a tricky question, how long ago, because I'm never really all the way out, clearly. But I left Care. I got into this business when I was a kid, literally 17. And I started in public radio. I was an anchor for Morning Edition in a regional part of the South for a couple of years. And then I got into television while I was going to college in Paducah, Kentucky. I was going to school at Murray State and was on air in Paducah. I got out east. A lot of big internships, fellowships at CBS and the Reagan White House doing news with the AP and some other organizations. And jumped over to Michigan for a couple of years to get back on air, and then went to CARE. I was like 24 years old, late 80s. I left there in 09. So I had 21 years, ultimately as an anchor and reporter at CARE Television. And when I left, you know, so that 09, it was just the impact, the early stage impact of digital news that, you know, is really, a lot of the broadcast television organizations still, you know, trying to figure out how to beat that game, right?
Right.
And what I decided to do at that point in my career was to try my luck at business. And I launched a very early version of curated news. It was called Bring Me the News back in 09, right when I left CARE. I also got into a business consortium that I built and managed for several major employers. And then a lot of new media space, online education, digital strategy, consultancy. And then we had to put one business down. We sold all of those, put one business down in the pandemic. And I had some time on my hands right there just trying to figure out what did I want to do. And I started looking into, you know, just what was happening in the Twin Cities. I mean, I saw it differently all of a sudden, because when I had to close the last business, I just went around and saw family in different parts of the country, different cities, out east, down south, out west. And I came back to the Twin Cities, and it just hit me like a brick. You know, I've been living there for a very long time, and I thought we were all just in kind of a funk from the pandemic and George Floyd and all the rioting. But this was 2023. So it was a few years past that. And I just started asking a lot of questions, trying to figure out, you know, other folks I would ask them, what do you see here? How do you read this? You know, and they would all put it in the context of, well, this is post-pandemic. This is what it does to America. This is work from home, you know? And I'm just thinking, you know, guys, you need to travel more, because, I mean, this is not what it looks like everywhere.
Yeah.
And then I got into the journalistic just measurements, right? Bureau of Labor Statistics, commercial real estate rankings, population migration, education performance. I got into all of these kinds of things, and especially crime, understanding that has been, I'm sure you're aware, a big challenge for us in the Twin Cities over the last several years, and it's really not abated much. So this was an effort to kind of put this all together, just figure out what were the common denominators, what were the common threads, and ultimately, you know, what was really driving this, and what was holding us back from being able to progress, to get back to some level of normalcy compared to other cities. And that's how this got developed and came out here just last night.
Were you trying to make any statements with this at all in terms of let's take aim at Minneapolis City Council, let's take aim at Tim Walz? I have to admit to you, I've not seen the whole thing yet. I'm about 20 minutes in. But were you trying to make any political statements at all?
No, and truth be told, so early in the work, so I worked on this for 2 years, okay? I started in October 23, and at the end of October 23, and at the beginning of October 25, we published for the first time, right? And so, and I would say for the first year, somebody in maybe the first 3 or 4 months had given me some information specifically about the presence of the Democratic Socialists of America on the Minneapolis City Council. And I looked into it a little bit, and I did not want to do a quote unquote political story. You know what I mean? I thought our society is so fractured by politics. You know, I thought if there's any way I can do this story without introducing political stuff. That's how I want to do it. And then as I got more and more work done, and I'd say by the end of year one, it became very clear that it was almost impossible to tell the story of what was ailing the Twin Cities and the state more broadly without talking about this very progressive, I hate to even use that term, but it's used a lot so people can kind of relate to it. But it's really, in the case of Minneapolis specifically, and frankly, the evidence of it at the state capitol is also quite measurable. But the degree to which the Democratic Socialists have managed the city of Minneapolis in particular, how they've used their leverage at the state capitol, I don't even really get into very much. I'm thinking about doing some more work on that. But you just can't tell the story, honestly, without addressing it. So that's why that's there. Their ideology is very, very different than what most people would say would be a Democratic, you know, ideology or a Republican ideology. I mean, a known kind of political ideology in our society is one thing. This is one that is not very well known.
Yeah, so I grew up in basically the northern suburbs of the Twin Cities, and I grew up in a Democrat household, became a conservative as I went through my life and life experiences. As I watched this, I said to myself, this to me looks like we have someone who is kind of a centrist, maybe more of a Democrat than a Republican, but is saying, look, even among some of the people on maybe my side, and I'm not asking you to label yourself, but it feels to me like you were calling out what you thought needed to be called out, and it didn't necessarily matter what party you were. You just felt like there's some stories that need to be told and some statistics that need to be shared. Am I right?
That's a very fair statement. That's a very fair statement.
What kinds of people, I understand that you have declined to say who funded this project, and I certainly understand that and respect your answer there, but I'm curious, what kinds of people wanted this story told? What are the common denominators among the people that said, yes, I'm willing to help you do this because this needs to get out? What kinds of people wanted this story told?
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm going to answer that question, then I want to come back to the premise, which is also accurate. That this is something that several people have started to talk about. Not a lot, I mean, like more than two. But the attributes, if you were to look at the attributes of the people that are talking about why they wanted to see this happen. There, what was moving them was, I'd say, literally on a spectrum. It sounds like kind of crazy, but true. They were on a spectrum from having a lot of passion for the Twin Cities as their home and how they've grown up, what they've known, and the fact that they don't have that anymore. So it was a deep personal concern about what was happening to their home. Okay? And then on another level, I would tell you, I sensed in several a real fear. And it was a fear of the consequence of the kind of change they could sense. The consequence being poor performance on a host of things, including ensuring safety, the education of their children, right? These things are motivators of funders for this work. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, I get exactly where you're coming from on that. I think that it makes sense to me. There's got to be people on both sides of the aisle, people from law enforcement, people from commerce, people from politics that are saying, you know, what's going on here? And I have to think, Rick, that in Minneapolis, they continue to elect these candidates and people to the Minneapolis City Council, but there have to be people in Minneapolis, business owners, families that just want quiet streets and neighborhoods and want to let their kids play outside without worrying again about getting shot. I've got to think there are plenty of people there, people like me who love that uptown area, and you just cry when you go down there now. But why do the people of Minneapolis keep electing the candidates that are bringing more and more of this ruin on the city of Minneapolis?
You know, once you're going to see that as you get deeper into this story, we make it quite clear. One of the big findings for us, and again, you know, I tell everybody at the end of the day, whatever else you want to call this, however else you want to receive it, you know, this is really a math story. It's a math story. And what we're doing is we are measuring all these different data sets. And one of them is looking at the city council. So one of the real conundrums was, okay, so the Minneapolis City Council has 13 people. And on that body, you know, 7 is a majority and 9 is a supermajority. 9 overrides a mayoral veto. And if you look at the city council, of that 13 people on the council, 4 ran for office as Democratic socialists, 4 of them. 3 of the 4 actually were dual endorsed. They were endorsed by both the DFL and the DSA. But in total, there were 4 that were endorsed DSA, 3 that were co-endorsed, 1 that was a lone DSA endorsed person. And I'm trying to figure out initially, another reason I didn't want to get into this real quick was because there's only 4 of them and there's 13 on the city council. And I'm like, how can anybody say that 4 of 13 is deciding the show, you know? But one of the things that we did was we did an analysis of all the voting on that city council in 2024, same group that's there right now. All of the voting they did. Now, the vast majority of what they do is unanimous. It's kind of formative work as a council together. They need to do certain things.
Right.
They do those things unanimously. But there was a subset of those that were contested votes. And we looked at how every single person on the city council voted. And then we looked at how the DSA group voted themselves in particular, how they were connected. And we then connected every other person on the city council, whether they were just the regular, I want to say standard DFL people. And we looked at the degree to which they voted with this DSA block. And at the end of the day, you know, we found members that decline to identify as Democratic Socialists who vote with the known Democratic Socialists more than most of the Democratic Socialists vote with the Democratic
Socialists. Yeah.
Do you understand?
Okay. Yeah.
So, in other words, there actually has been multiple times in 2024 and since, where the mayor has been overridden with a DSA-aligned block of council members. And what that says is, at the end of the day, there's a bunch of people who don't want to say that they're voting DSA and that they honor the DSA objectives or goals. But when it comes to voting in crucial matters of the city council, they align with the DSA.
Yes, they do.
And that's the truth. And that's why there's so much of this going on. That, you know, the DSA organization, do you know much about this group? I'm curious.
Yeah,
I don't know if you do or not.
I've not looked into it. I've heard that if you take a look at their credo, that it's pretty disturbing. But I'm hearing that from people like myself who are pretty strong conservatives. So, Rick, I only have about 30 seconds left, and I love the conversation. I could talk to you all night about this, but if I could get kind of your final thoughts on this as we finish up, that would be wonderful.
Surely. My hope in doing all this is simply that, is it to educate the public? Okay, that's it. That's the game of journalism. And that's my hope here. I don't know what we're going to find out. I don't know if this, we're going to wake them up and they're going to realize what's going on and they're going to think harder about what they want to do and how they want to influence their own future.
Yeah.
Or if they're going to all, you know, they maybe all lean into this path. I don't know what will happen, but I have more hope that they're going to understand it better than they did before.
Well, as someone who loves Minnesota and the Twin Cities, who still feels like it's home and who weeps for that great city and what it's become, I'm so thankful that you did this. And I hope you do more. I'd like to see more about Tim Walz. I would like to see more about, where do we start? Is it law enforcement? Is it commerce? How do we start? Because I don't believe that Minneapolis is too far gone, but it's going to take some big changes, and it's going to take them pretty quick. Rick, thank you a ton for taking the time to do this. Thanks for your great work here, and I can't wait to watch the last 40 minutes.
Well, God bless you. Thank you so much for taking the time.
You got it. Thank you for taking the time. We know it's been a crazy week. Thank you very much, Rick. Take care. Rick Cupcella, the main man behind A Precarious State. Sounds like he's got more bullets in the chamber, and I like that. We need more of that. Steve Hallstrom Show, back after this. Great conversation. He's a deep thinker, you can tell. It took him a while to get through a couple of questions. I wanted to ask him, where would you start? If someone made you king, where would you start? In my mind, it has to be something with law enforcement. Because when you look at what's happened, it's the crime that's driven out so much business of like places like Uptown. And then you have to have more of an economic, a free markets approach there, and lowering taxes and government spending. So there's that side of it too. I wanted to ask him a little bit about, I'm hearing from people that he really left the gloves off when it came to Tim Walz. And would have liked to hear a little bit more about why that. I mean, apparently he took a lot of aim at city council, and that's the part that I saw. But you got to see this. There's some of these pieces of information are amazing. It's good stuff. Check it out, A Precarious State. Have a great night and great weekend. Keep on flying that flag.